Welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, August 15th, 2021. I'm your volunteer reader, Amy B. Let's get started with the news. The first front page story is by Zachary DuPont. He writes, Manly Mayor Reagan Banks swears at councillor during meeting. An improper payment of $150 to Manly Mayor Reagan Banks has become a significant point of controversy over the past 2 months. Iowa Auditor Rob Sands' office audit of the city of Manly cited Banks for receiving three separate $50 payments for meetings canceled by the COVID-19 pandemic in the spring of 2020, totaling $150. The auditor's office recommended in its report that the city should seek reimbursement. At the time, Banks said that he intended to reimburse the city and was not even aware of the payments until a few months before the state audit. Now it's been nearly 2 months since the state audit was released, and Banks has yet to reimburse the city, to the consternation of community members who have begun to speak up about it. Manly City Council member Richard Baird brought the issue up at the most recent City Council meeting on August 3rd. Banks responded by saying he was not at fault. The person who wrote the check needed to be talked to, and that his lawyer is investigating how he had received the payments in the first place. Banks added that he wouldn't take any more questions until the investigation by his lawyer is complete. Shortly after the minute-long conversation, Banks can be heard muttering the phrase, "stupid expletive." In a recording of the meeting made by the city and requested by the Globe Gazette, Baird said in an interview with the Globe after the meeting that he's disappointed in how the mayor has handled the situation and wishes only for the city to be in compliance with the state. I strongly believe how the mayor handled the issue was very inappropriate and in poor judgment, Baird said. All I wanted to do is have the city in compliance with their recommendations set forward by the auditor's office. According to Baird, a third party anonymously gave the city $150 to cover the reimbursement cost, but it's unclear if that money can be accepted by the city or not. When the Globe Gazette reached out to Banks for comment, he hung up after hearing what the phone call was in reference to and did not respond to any follow-up calls. Baird and another city employee who wished to remain anonymous for fear of retaliation said that outbursts and name-calling from Banks are not uncommon, even at city council meetings. I am not after the mayor, but this is about the third time he's really blown up at people, Baird said. Like I said, it just seemed very inappropriate. Such a blow-up happened later on in the same meeting when a discussion about the police department got heated and a member of the audience spoke up in defense of council member Mary Derner. After Banks asked her not to speak unless called upon, he had her thrown out of the city council meeting. While being removed, the audience member shouted, "You've paid that $150 back? Lord knows the town wants to know," at Banks. This is Banks' second stint as mayor of Manly, winning his first election in 2003 and serving until 2007. Banks again became mayor in 2017, winning a special election, and then winning re-election in 2020. Banks' current term ends in 2023. Banks also serves as the youth director of the North Iowa Youth Center in Mason City. Concerns mount over COVID-19 in schools, by Abby Koch. Back to school means new supplies, a new grade level, and a whole new level of concern about COVID-19. The number of Iowans hospitalized with COVID-related illnesses stood at 355 this week, the highest since 360 on February 4th. Of those hospitalized, 103 were in intensive care units, and 49 needed the aid of ventilators to breathe, according to the latest weekly figures issued by the state. Through Monday, August 9th, data on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website shows that the positive 7-day test rate for COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo County is around 7.62%, with a testing volume of about 446 people over the same time period. Up to Friday, August 13th, the coronavirus.iowa.gov website shows that the 7-day positive test rate for Cerro Gordo County is around 6%, with 23% of those positive, or about 11 people, being 17 and younger. The highest age range was 18 to 29, which accounted for 54% of the positive tests, or about 28 people. CG Public Health Director Brian Hanft says that he is highly concerned about this upcoming school year due to the rise in case numbers and the Delta variant. "I firmly believe that what was done last year kept people safe," Hanft said Thursday afternoon. According to Hanft, in-person schooling is the best option for students this year if everyone wears masks and stays socially distanced. He added that these methods kept the spread of COVID-19 limited and next to no spread within schools, according to data. But with the state banning mask mandates in schools earlier this year, Hanft is concerned about the spread of COVID-19 and other ailments for the school year. "We all wore masks last year, and it dramatically took down influenza numbers," Hanft said. When it came to the number of children being hospitalized due to COVID-19, Hanft said that he couldn't speak to the number of kids being hospitalized, but he was receiving statewide data showing hospitals were filling up with school-aged patients. He added that things were becoming dire in the area. The Clear Lake School Board approved and released its Return to Learn plan. On August 10th, Superintendent Doug G. made it clear that there was parts that could be determined by the district and parts that were controlled by the state. "A lot of stuff is beyond our control," said G. Clear Lake students do not have a virtual option this upcoming year, according to G, and the district plan. Virtual schooling would only be given to students who test positive, who would then receive a device to do lessons and connect through scheduled times with their teachers. The districts will keep in place the cleaning efforts that were implemented last year and encourage students to keep their hands clean. G said the district would continue to encourage people to do what they can to beat the virus. "We are going to do everything we can to mitigate and keeping our kids and teachers safe," said G. Clear Lake is also not going to require a student to take a test or do contact tracing this upcoming school year. The quarantine period for Clear Lake students would be 10 days from when they first show symptoms. Mason City School District is returning to face-to-face learning with the option to instead enroll in the district's virtual academy. Mason City Superintendent Dave Versteeg said the virtual option was better for some students, along with easing the minds of those with health concerns. Versteeg said the district would maintain its cleaning efforts and continue to encourage distancing. He added that the district would encourage those who are unvaccinated or feel uncomfortable to wear masks, and for all to get vaccinated. "I think we are bringing attention that it is fine to be masked and being very supportive of it," said Versteeg. Versteeg said the district would be monitoring to see if there is an upturn in cases and working closely with CG Public Health. He did not want to comment on what the quarantine process for those testing positive would be this year, since the district is still waiting for instruction. "We are doing everything that we can to keep students safe and in school," said Versteeg. Hanft's advice for parents who are about to send their child to school this fall is to have them continue to wear masks and to get children 12 and up vaccinated. Hanft said everyone at public health or working in healthcare is tired, and the rise in cases is stretching them even more. He asks people that before students return to the classroom to please go get vaccinated. "I'm just asking people to do this out of the goodness of their hearts," said Hanft. A memorable mystery. Van Horn Trial 106 Years Ago Gripped Cerro Gordo County and Beyond by Jared McNett. In October 1929, just weeks before the Black Tuesday stock market sell-off signaled the beginning of the Great Depression in the United States, Cerro Gordo County resident Charlotte Van Horn headed west with her son Chandler and niece to find a new home and a new life in Los Angeles. Not long before the move, Van Horn sold off a farm near Clear Lake that had belonged to her and her former husband, Chester Chet Van Horn. For years, the couple, who were about a decade's difference in age, lived in a home 4 miles southwest of town until Chet was found dead after an apparent suicide on the morning of Friday, November 20th, 1914, by Charlotte. An initial article from the Marshalltown Evening Times Republican said Chet died from a gunshot wound sometime during the night, and Charlotte made the discovery after returning home from a night in town on November 19th. That narrative lasted little more than a month before Charlotte was arrested in Des Moines on New Year's Eve and charged with the first-degree murder of Chet. That arrest kicked off a 4-month whirlwind of coverage that swept up every corner of the state of Iowa. A simple perusal through newspapers.com kicks up articles on the case from not just Mason City, but Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, the Quad Cities, Sioux City, Waterloo, Dubuque, Marshalltown, Ottumwa, and Muscatine as well. Though some of the earliest articles about the arrest, such as the one from the Webster City Freeman on Tuesday, January 5th, 1915, do mention the murder charge, they also share an existing consensus opinion from around the time of Chet's death that he did in fact kill himself because of domestic unhappiness and frequent marital quarreling. In May of the same year, an article from the Marshalltown Evening Times Republican relayed testimony from the trial that the Van Horns had not lived happily together for some time and were separated for about a year. What had previously been used to explain a suicide had since shifted to a possible motive for murder. That Freeman article let it be known that when Charlotte was arrested in Des Moines, she was being treated for a nervous breakdown at Hill's Retreat, which was a private sanatorium established in 1905 by Dr. Gershom Hill and Dr. John Doolittle on property formerly owned by philanthropist James Callanan. When Cerro Gordo County Sheriff Fred Marsh brought Charlotte back to Mason City, she first went to Park Hospital. A Des Moines Register article from Friday, January 8, 1915, reported that after the adjournment of an initial court date, her brother, Ralph Callanan, said that he believed Charlotte had been mentally unbalanced for about half a decade. A court exhibit from April 28, 1915, shows a deputy sheriff, H.W. Knapp, saying that he talked with Charlotte about Chet's death and that at no time, when asked, did she ever deny the shooting. When I first met her, she seemed to be cheerful and carried an ordinary conversation in an ordinary way, Knapp said. The coroner, Dr. W.E. Long, said that when he performed the autopsy, Charlotte was there and didn't appear to show any emotion at all. Around January 8th, Charlotte was able to secure the $7,500 needed for bail with help from her family. That sprung her from Cerro Gordo County and got her back to Hill's Retreat. But that freedom was fleeting. A Monday, February 1st, 1915 article in the Cedar Rapids Gazette noted that Charlotte Van Horn went back to Mason City on January 24th after having her bond revoked. It then ends with quite the piece of speculation. Persons who live at Clear Lake and know the Van Horn family stated that she was friendly with her husband's brother, but no evidence regarding these relations was brought out at the hearing. The dateline in the Waterloo Courier is Tuesday, February 2nd, 1915 in Mason City. And Rollo Van Horn has been arrested on the charge of murdering his brother Chet. He is supposed to have been arrested as a result of statements by Mrs. Charles Van Horn widow of Chester Van Horn, the article states. The piece then lets it be known that an affinity case is alleged to have been the motive for the murder. Per an Iowa court ruling from 1892, the meaning of affinity is well established. It is the relationship which one spouse has, because of the marriage, to blood relatives of the other. In what appears to be pre-trial testimony on behalf of the state, a Clear Lake resident named May Yon said that she boarded with the Van Horns from Friday nights to Monday mornings while she taught school, and that she saw Charlotte with Rollo a little, but Yon couldn't say that she'd ever seen them alone together. A Mrs. Henrietta Hackett testified that she had known of Charlotte's relations with Rollo Van Horn for some years. Rollo's time in the barrel didn't last long. A story in the Humiston New Era from Wednesday, February 10, 1915, reports that Rollo Van Horn was released from custody. Lightning changes in the murder mystery of Chester Van Horn was the summary of the developments. Nancy Bowers, who wrote about the Van Horn case in 2011 for the Iowa Unsolved Mysteries Historic Cases website and lists working for law enforcement in the credentials on that site, said that she took note of those lightning-fast changes, too. I believe I was surprised that the brother's possible involvement was so quickly dismissed, Bowers wrote in an email. One of Bowers' greatest interests in the case with Charlotte was her presentation throughout the proceedings. As is often the case in contemporary crimes, the suspect became the focus of attention. I believe she carefully orchestrated that, Bowers wrote. The veil to tantalizingly hide her face, the carefully chosen quasi-sailor suit to suggest a childlike innocence, the move into a swanky hotel, the dramatic protestations of weariness, the treatments at the nervous invalid's home, etc. Neither she nor the press seemed inclined to mention the victim and the crime. In that Marshalltown Evening Times Republican piece, however, the reporting does take time out to mention that Charlotte wore a veil continually and protested against publicity. Bowers covers an episode in her story that finds Charlotte at a particularly weary time. Bowers retells a scene in the Globe Gazette where Charlotte and Ralph spend an evening sitting in the writing room of the historic Park Inn, responding to questions from a reporter. The only word Charlotte Van Horn uttered was, "Oh, I'm so tired tonight," Bowers' piece recounts. A reprieve of sorts did eventually come for Charlotte, at least as it relates to the case. After less than a full week of the actual trial, Charlotte was found not guilty of the crime of murdering her husband, Chet. Per a Sunday, May 2nd article from the Sioux City Journal, Charlotte is said to have wept upon the reading of the verdict for the trial, which officially lasted but a few days. However, those few days did feature quite a few theories that the prosecutors tried to throw at the wall and get to stick. Two state witnesses said they saw Charlotte and another person driving in the direction of the farm on the night that Chet died, when she was supposed to have been in town celebrating a birthday. A. W. Vergberg said that on November 19, 1914, she met Charlotte Van Horn going out of Clear Lake at about 8:30 p.m. A Mr. R. F. Fletcher said that a short time after 8 p.m., he saw Charlotte Van Horn and another person driving south past the Outing Club, which still exists on South Shore Drive. I have known Charlotte Van Horn for probably 25 years and am not mistaken that it was she at that time as she passed under an electric light. The other, I believe, was a man, Fletcher said. Another postulated that Charlotte had surreptitiously got a revolver in the mail and discarded evidence of that fact. Authorities tried to make the case that Charlotte had acquired the name under an assumed name, though the connection only went as far as one witness, Floyd Grimm, who said they saw Charlotte with a small brown paper package on November 14th. and another, a cashier named R.H. Patterson, testifying that on November 14th, a woman did sign for a package addressed to a David E. DeVera. Mason City Police Sergeant Gregory Scott, who does history work for the department, said that looking back into old cases, even ones with some semblance of a resolution, can be difficult to do. Mostly people have just forgotten about them because of time. When you read these old reports, the street names are different because they change the names, so sometimes it's hard to find where the homicide happened, Scott said. Fran Van Horn, a granddaughter of Charlotte's, wasn't aware of any details about the case at all until she saw Bauer's story a few years back. She said her father didn't speak much about that period of time in Charlotte's life. I know my dad and mom visited her in L.A. most weekends, where she lived with my dad's cousin Eunice, who was the other child sent to the neighbors on the evening before my grandfather's death, until she passed away, Fran wrote in an email. She said that she's tried to find Charlotte's Los Angeles residence on Google Earth and can't, and believes it was likely raised at some point in the past. The only details that Fran said that her mother told her was that her grandfather died by suicide and that Charlotte took tap dancing lessons later in her life. None of that comes up in the 20th anniversary blurb that appeared in the Globe Gazette on Wednesday, January 2nd, 1935. No stories about tap dancing lessons or theories of revolvers or gothic description of a woman cloaked in a veil. There's no mention of nervous breakdowns or speculative love triangles. The recap distills the most high-profile period of Charlotte's life into a single sentence. Quote, 20 years ago, Charlotte Van Horn was arrested at Des Moines yesterday and charged with the murder of her husband, Chester Van Horn, on November 20th at Clear Lake. Close quote. The next article is by Zachary DuPont. Strong Tower to premiere at Surf Ballroom. The pilot episode of a television show filmed in North Iowa will be premiered at the Surf Ballroom next week. Strong Tower is a show produced by the Renovo Media Group, based locally in the Clear Group. Renovo filmed the pilot episode of the show in both Clear Lake and Mason City back in May earlier this year. Starring Claire Coffey, Michael Gross, and Miriam Flynn, Strong Tower is a show about a recently widowed woman who moves back to her hometown in the Midwest with her two teenage sons to open a brew house. Strong Tower filmed at iconic locations across Iowa, including downtown Clear Lake by the Starboard Market, St. Joseph's Catholic Church, and downtown Mason City inside Mason City Brewing. Renovo produced the pilot episode without a partnership with any streaming service for distribution, but hopes that it will be picked up by one of the streaming services like Netflix or Hulu based on the quality of its pilot episode. Only the first episode of Strong Tower has been filmed thus far, but Renovo hopes to film the rest of the 7 to 8 episodes in North Iowa if it's picked up by a streaming service. The pilot episode will be premiered at 6 p.m. Wednesday. Admission to the event is free, and a cash bar will be available. Renovo was created last year as an offshoot of another Clear Lake establishment, Kingland Systems, a technology company. Todd Rognes, CEO of Kingland, said that Renovo is now its own entity, run by Clear Lake locals, with the goal of creating family-themed content for streaming services. Strong Tower is what Rognes and Kingland Systems hope to be the first of many productions for Renovo Media. Zachary DuPont writes, Clear Lake business owners moving fair to Altoona. The Des Moines Renaissance Fair will have a new home starting in 2022 at Adventureland in Altoona, Iowa. The Des Moines Renaissance Fair is put together by Festivals International, a company based in Clear Lake, and organizers were looking for an opportunity to leave their previous location in Sailorville. We were beginning to outgrow our old locations, festival International owner and operator Greg Schmidt said, "Our parking was real limited. We knew our days were numbered. Then the opportunity arose for the Des Moines Renaissance Fair to operate in the Altoona Theme Park Adventureland's new development called the Meadowlands. The new Meadowlands expansion that will allow the Des Moines Renaissance Fair to continue operations and grow the show. When Adventureland called, it's like a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow," Schmidt said. "We are just over the moon." The Des Moines Renaissance Fair will feature live music, games, and historical reenactments, and will potentially have features like a Napa Theater, Renaissance-themed walls, and a children's play area built over the next few years. Adventureland will also have a bridge constructed to connect the Meadowlands to the theme park for Platinum Season Pass holders to enter events at the Meadowlands free of charge. The Des Moines Renaissance Fair is aiming to host its first event in the new location next spring on May 7th and 8th, and another event the following weekend on May 14th and 15th. Schmidt also hopes to hold events in September of 2022. As part of the new arrangement, Adventureland is allowing Festival's international creative team, which includes Greg Schmidt and his wife Bonnie, to produce other family-friendly events for the Meadowlands. We'll probably also kick off one event each month in between our Renaissance fairs, Schmidt said. We're just champing at the bit to show what we can do with our creativity at this new venue. Festivals International is also responsible for putting together the Iowa Minnesota Pirate Festival, which is taking place in Clear Lake next month from September 11th to 12th. Adventureland has already begun the designing process for the Meadowlands, with a plan for the Renaissance Fair to be the opening event for the expansion in May of 2022. PEO grant awarded. Jessica Bone, a student at North Iowa Community College, was awarded a PEO program for continuing education grant from the PEO Sisterhood. She was sponsored by PEO Chapter LE of Clear Lake. Bond was awarded the Chapter ML Iowa named grant in honor of Marsha Meyer's 100th birthday. Bond is pursuing a licensed practical nursing degree. Vitzum named CEO of Iowa State Bank. The Board of Directors of Iowa State Bank have named Lori Vitzum as President and CEO, effective August 2nd. Vitzum will lead the $400 million community bank and its 51 employees in the Algona, Corwith, Ruthven, and Wesley markets. Vitzum has served as Chief Financial Officer since 2002 and has been with the bank since 1990. She holds a BA degree from the University of Texas in Arlington and is a certified public accountant. Iowa State Bank is owned by the Mid-Iowa Bank Shares Company of Algona, a one-bank holding company devoted to community banking in north-central Iowa. Hancock County Farmers named to Iowa Young Farmer Committee. A Hancock County farmer has been named to the leadership of the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation Young Farmer Advisory Committee for 21-22. These officers and district representatives are committed to uniting young farmers ages 18 to 35 throughout the state through engaging programs and events, including the annual IFBF Young Farmer Conference, which draws hundreds of young farmers and agribusiness leaders together to connect and share ideas. Vanessa Tremple is a licensed practical nurse, and her husband, Cody, is a crop specialist. The two raise corn, soybeans, alfalfa, cattle, and hogs on their farm, along with two children. The Tremples are active Hancock County Farm Bureau members, serve with North Iowa Ag in the classroom, and are members of the Garner Chamber of Commerce. New district representatives joining the committee include the Tramples, Sam and Danielle Bennett of Ida County, and Court and Krista Hullum of Tama County. These new committee members will serve 3-year terms as communicators for their districts. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, August 15th, 2021 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Donald K. Johnson, November 9, 1927 to June 12. Donald K. Johnson, age 93, of Northwood, passed away Saturday, June 12, at the IOOF home in Mason City. A celebration of life in his honor will be held 6 p.m. Friday, August 20th at the Northwood VFW in Northwood, Iowa. Donald will be laid to rest in the South Shell Rock Cemetery. The family will greet friends from 4:30 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the VFW. Don Kenneth Johnson was born November 9, 1927 in rural Thompson, Iowa, the son of Engwald and Amanda Johnson Johnson. Donna J. Oliver, age 83, of Dowse, passed away on Saturday, July 17th at the Rehabilitation Center of Hampton. Visitation will be held Saturday, August 21st from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. at the Dowse Legion Post number 523 in Dowse. Private family burial will take place at Fairview Cemetery in Dowse. Ewing Funeral Home in Dowse, Iowa, is in charge of arrangements. Earl Palmer Madsen, April 9, 1930 to August 8. Earl Palmer Madsen, age 91, of Northwood, passed away August 8, 2021 after a lengthy illness. A family graveside service was held at North Shell Rock Cemetery, rural Northwood, Iowa. Earl was born in Worth County, Iowa, on April 9, 1930, the last of seven children born to Peter and Ida Loken Madsen. Earl graduated from Northwood High School in 1948 and began working at Wilson & Company in Albert Lea, Minnesota. He entered the U.S. Army in September 1951 and served in Europe as a combat medical specialist. After his honorable discharge in August 1953, he returned to Northwood to his childhood home and began farming, raising a variety of crops and livestock, his vocation for the next 60 years. Earl married Beverly Norland on January 9, 1954, and during their 67 years of marriage, they raised five children. Earl was above all else a great husband, father, and grandfather. He made certain to attend every possible event his children and grandchildren were involved with, from school music concerts to athletic contests. Earl was also interested in soil conservation and was an early adopter of ridge tilling. He served terms as a township trustee and as a member of the Worth County Co-op Oil Company Board. In addition, Earl served as a member of the Worth County Historical Society and was a member of the Fraternal Order of Eagles. Connor Colonial Chapel in Northwood, Iowa, is in charge of arrangements. Cordelia Cork Nitschter, September 10, 1934 to August 8. Cordelia Cork Nitschter of Council Bluffs passed away August 8 at her home. She was born to Dr. Arthur and Louise Seegers, September 10, 1934, in Parkersburg. Cork graduated from Grafton High School in 1953. She married George Nitschter, Jr. on April 1, 1956. Cork was a terrific wife, mother, and domestic engineer. She had a sweet personality that everyone who met her enjoyed. She was very thoughtful and kept in touch with friends and family by writing many letters. She will be greatly missed. Private services were held. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be sent to the American Heart Association. Richard Moorhead passed away November 19, 2020. A celebration of his life will be held August 21, 2021 at St. Joseph Epiphany Parish at 10:30 a.m., followed by lunch and sharing memories at East Park No. 2 Shelter House. Please wear masks at church. Helga Ann Borgman, September 17, 1936 to August 10. Helga Ann Borgman, age 84, of Clear Lake, died Tuesday, August 10, under the care of Mercy One North Iowa Hospice at Oakwood Care Center in Clear Lake. She died peacefully with her husband at her side. A private family celebration of life will be held at First Congregational Church in Clear Lake, with Reverend Harlan Serry officiating. Visitation for friends and family will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, September 2nd at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel in Clear Lake. Anne donated her body to the University of Iowa Deeded Body Program for medical research. Her body will be cremated and spread in the Pacific Ocean off her beloved Kaiwakapu Beach on Maui, Hawaii. In lieu of customary remembrances, memorials in Anne's honor may be directed to Mercy One North Iowa Hospice, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, or to the First Congregational Church in Clear Lake. Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel in Clear Lake is in charge of arrangements. William Bill F. Bell, age 70, of Clemmy, passed away Friday, July 30th at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center, surrounded by his family. Celebration of life for William Bill Bell will be held Saturday, August 21st at 2:30 p.m. at Eldred Sherwood Park, Indian Lake, Shelter House, 2185 120th Street in Goodell, Iowa. Lunch following memorial service. Bring your lawn chairs and a beverage of your choice. Ewing Funeral Home of Belmont, Iowa is in charge of arrangements. This concludes today's obituaries. Going back to the news stories now. Forest City 5K Run raises nearly $20,000. Benefits first responders and veterans. Area communities coalesced around first responders and military veterans in a big way on the morning of August 7th in Forest City. Months of pre-planning enabled Forest City to host the Tunnel to Towers 5K Run Walk fundraising event. This honors a firefighter, Steven Siller, who gave his life on September 11th, volunteer race director Amy Ryan said. It honors his sacrifice and then the sacrifices of other firefighters and first responders nationwide and locally. He said this year's Tunnel to Towers Foundation Run Walk was Forest City's third annual event. However, it was not held last year due to COVID-19. Among its many contributions to those in the nation's front lines, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation builds mortgage-free smart homes for catastrophically injured veterans and first responders. Organizers announced that more than 250 such homes have been delivered and an additional 200 are anticipated to be delivered by year's end. This is by far the best year we've had in Forest City so far, Ryan said. We raised over $19,000, and there were two young brothers from Kanawha who made a great contribution. They held a lemonade stand this past week that raised over $1,000 in a matter of hours. It was one of the best feel-good moments. Those young boys are Wyatt and Waylon Brogard, sons of Jeremy and Julie Brogard of Kanawha. Jeremy said that he and a fellow firefighter had joined the Forest City event when his sons decided to raise funds for it themselves with a last-minute lemonade stand set up from 3:30 to 5 p.m. near the Kanawha Fire Station on August 6th. They also sold homemade cookies made just the night before. My wife posted details on Facebook, and so many people physically showed up, Jeremy said. They collected about $835 in cash and probably about $1,200 total with funds that people wired. I was shocked how much they raised in the little town of Kanawha. A formal presentation of a $10,000 donation by Pritchard GMC in Brett occurred just prior to the start of the morning's 5K, 3.1 miles, run-walk. What a great cause, Ellen Pritchard said. We could not think of a better cause to support that came to celebrate your 5K. The Forest City Emergency Services Center parking lot served as home base for the event, with Panel Park and the Winnebago River as scenic backdrops. Many first responders from across north central Iowa ran or walked in full gear on a warm summer's morning as a display of dedicated unity for the cause. The Winnebago County Sheriff's Department, as well as Forest City, Lake Mills, and Kanawha firefighters and first responders were just a few participants. American flags were flying above Forest City Fire Department ladder trucks and on the backs of many of the full gear firemen and first responders who participated. KIOW Radio set up a broadcast booth and provided live music in the back parking lot. "The event is a non-competitive run and walk," Ryan said, "honoring and remembering the fallen of 9/11 and giving back to the foundation are our primary goals." Ryan and many others worked hard since this spring to increase the Forest City event participation and fundraising numbers in 2021. Although those numbers had been good the last couple of years prior to the pandemic as well. Ryan returned to Forest City with aspirations of elevating this event, for which he helped raise more than $70 between Forest City and Ankeny over several years previously. She noted that each event is doing so much good for those who serve and protect us all. She cited how funds help pay for smart homes for wounded veterans who have difficulty fending for themselves because of injuries and disabilities sustained in their service. She also noted that it helps pay for home mortgages of the families of fallen first responders, among many other things. Born from the tragedy of 9/11, the Tunnel to Towers Foundation carries forward a legacy of courage and heroism, Ryan said. Built upon the mantra, "While we have time, let us do good," the foundation supports the nation's fallen and catastrophically injured first responders, military heroes, and their families. Ryan said event organizers, participants, volunteers, and donors joined together in this fundraising cause to help and make a positive difference. Many area participants register and participate as well as help fundraise for the cause. Some just make a donation and everything helps, she notes. Along with the Brogards, the Kanawha and Forest City Fire Departments were top fire fundraisers at more than $1,000 each. The Lake Mills Fire Department raised about $600. Mark Frakes donated $500. The events included categories for children 12 and under and 13 to 17, adults, first responders, and military, and even virtual runners and walkers. All attendees, in person or virtual, were given the opportunity to fundraise for the cause. Ryan thanked all donors for their generosity on the 20th anniversary of those lost on 9/11. A goal of all local Tunnel to Towers events is also to honor their memory. The Tunnel to Towers Run Walk was created to honor the heroic and life and death of Stephen Siller, a New York City firefighter who lost his life on September 11, 2001, after strapping on his gear and running through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel to the Twin Towers. Ryan said the event honors all of those who lost their lives on 9/11 and supports first responders and military members who make extraordinary sacrifices in the line of duty. J.W. Sales continues here his story about Solomon Stratton. This column is the fourth in a series that highlights the lives of three Black North Iowa farmers and their struggles. He writes about Solomon Stratton, Emancipation to Gettysburg. 1863 was the year of years for Private Saul Stratton. From January to late June 1863, the 8th Illinois served in support, reconnaissance, and picket duties, which afforded Stratton and Verbeck ample time to shore up specifics and agreements for both of their post-war lives. The land that Lieutenant Verbeck had acquired since 1860 was some of the best virgin prairie in Iowa. He had already decided that he was going to move his family from Illinois to a half-section farm near Grinnell, Iowa. His friendship and respect for Solomon Stratton led his offer of a partnership in his Worth County, Iowa land, with the plan being, once Saul was established, for Beck would sell him his land for $2 per acre, a bargain if there was one. Once Saul was mustered out, he was to head to Iowa, validate the land claims, and begin at once to break the prairie into suitable farmland. The only stumble block of import to this roadmap, to their futures, was staying alive through the many battles to come before their muster out. When I began to put the life stories of Solomon Stratton, Wallace McKinney, and William Wright, three black soldiers who served in the Civil War and who became successful and respected farmers in North Iowa, to paper, I had planned to herald, reinforce, and emphasize their unusual successes and prodigious family life, all in a place where 95% of the population was white and European. Yet North Iowa was and is not an island. Life as a black family after the Civil War anywhere in America has been peppered with latent and overt acts of prejudice and perpetuation of inequality. The racial strife and discrimination, together with separate but equal doctrine, given Supreme Court precedents in the 1896 case Plessy v. Ferguson, has prevailed well into the 20th and 21st centuries. It took until 1954, when the court overturned Plessy with Brown v. the Board of Education, for segregation to begin to be brought down. Yet it took nearly 100 years after the end of the Civil War before President Lyndon Johnson used over 70 pens to ink into law the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that made it illegal to segregate any public place or discriminate in any manner. I have read thousands of pages with the initial intent to illustrate that the subjects of these profiles had come to North Iowa, had been embraced and treated as equals. The very few writings relating to these men, written in white papers back in the day, praised them in their obituaries, as they had not been acknowledged during their lives. However, the inconvenient truths manifested throughout their successes and their demonstrated fortitude to overcome not only the scourges of pioneer life and the often cruel hand of Mother Nature, but also that these families had been followed by the quiet stealth of discrimination and bias from slavery to freedom in North Iowa. The joys of life and success hinged on the strength and support of the black community in North Iowa and the black-owned press, through a quiet understanding and a practice of separate but equal. Once again, America sloths forward at the ubiquitous, painstaking, slow pace of aspiring to live up to the grand words of freedom contained in our Constitution. On June 30, 1863, the 8th Illinois encamped at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Although every soldier on both sides knew battle was imminent, few thought the carnage would go down in history as the single deadliest battle ever fought on the North American continent. The 8th Illinois Volunteer Cavalry Regiment, as throughout the war, was at the front and epicenter of the inevitable bloodbath that was Gettysburg. Company D, with Carlos Verbeck in command and Saul Stratton on the line with him, flanked by Companies E and F, made up the Corps Vedette line as the Union awaited the onslaught of armies thrown at armies. At 7 a.m. on July 1, 1863, just 20 feet down the line from Saul Stratton, Company E Commander Lieutenant Marcellus Jones dismounted his horse, asked his first lieutenant, Levi Schaefer, for his Spencer carbine, aimed carefully at the phalanx of Confederate Army crossing the Marsh Creek Bridge, and fired the first shot of more than 1 million rounds fired over those 3 days in July. The Battle of Gettysburg was a Union victory and turned the tide of the outcome of the war. It was also the site of Abraham Lincoln's most powerful speech. His next edition, which should be in next Sunday's paper, will be entitled Mustering Out and Coming Home. And the author of these articles about Solomon Stratton is J.W. Sales, a Mason City resident. Let's look at some letters to the editor now. The first one is by Karen Weber of Charles City. She writes, Biden needs to pull an FDR. We have a political bully tactic problem in this country. It's Republicans. Bullies are cowards. If you smack a bully in the face, he or she will run. Democrats need to get a spine and fight back. Nancy Pelosi seems to be the most Democratic official who is fighting back. Bipartisanship is bunk. We need to get these bills passed and stop letting Republicans put off the passing of them. Republicans say they are the serious party, but they have no agenda except stopping voting and stopping passing of bills. And let's not tax big corporations. We need to get rid of the Trump occult before the country becomes a country run by a ruler and another Russian rule. The next letter is by Irma Peterson of Mason City. She writes, "Ask your doctor about the vaccination. A little knowledge is dangerous. You need the full story." Excuse me. "Go to your doctor and find out why you need to be vaccinated to help you in fighting COVID-19. There is a real bad one out there right now. Just ask your doctor. Be a good neighbor." The next letter is written by Alvin Blake of Mason City. He writes, "Apply the carrot and stick to foreign diplomacy. I'm not sure if hypersonic missiles or Iran's drones have a chance of first strike capability. If so, or if some countries will think so and or don't fear a second strike, then we need to take preventative steps. The same applies to nuclear weapons, with or without these, and perhaps likewise even poison gas. If there is a chance of conquest by China, Iran, or North Korea, or a chance of destruction by any of those countries or by Russia, we need a freeze on new missiles and or weapons of those sorts. There should be an immediate inspection of any suspicious sites in order to verify this. If they don't fear a second strike or would furnish to terrorists, we need to have them dismantle what they already have, again with immediate inspection. Perhaps the way to do this is by offering and or establishing increased trade while threatening increased sanctions, with the spread wide enough so that they won't want to miss our chance of missing any of the sites. For Russia, we might also try diplomacy, like a NATO invitation. Alternatively, increased economic ties might forestall destruction. For North Korea, perhaps we might also give them a choice between denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula or putting enough arms in North Korea nearby to destroy them. Perhaps we can bring about human rights, such as freedom of religion, and perhaps we can get China to stop supporting North Korea if nothing else works with the latter." The next letter is written by Chris Gannett Sanchez of Mason City. She writes, "On May 20th, Kim Reynolds signed legislation that blocks mask mandates in schools and prohibits cities and counties from requiring masks. She did this the night prior to my daughter's last day of school. Very few students wore masks. Some teachers wore them in solidarity. The Delta variant of COVID is 9 times more contagious than the common cold and has also infected the vaccinated. Although they do not get as sick as the unvaccinated, they are infected with the same amount of the virus. As the start of school approaches, the law prohibiting schools to require masks is a disaster waiting to strike with a vengeance. More younger children who are not able to be vaccinated are coming down with COVID-19, and some are dying. I got COVID, and although I was asymptomatic, I missed over a week of work. My daughter had a mild case and was out of school for the whole month of December. My ex-husband entered the hospital on Christmas Day and was on a ventilator for 2 weeks. After he got out, he had to stay with my daughter and her fiancé due to his cognitive decline before he could go home. I don't want my family or me to get sick again. I want to be able to visit my parents and see my siblings from Minneapolis. I don't want more students to fall behind and get depressed. Parents, teachers, and business owners who don't want to have labor shortages due to employees' illnesses or due to parents quitting to be at home with their children for online learning, please hound our governor and our Republican leaders to have an emergency legislative session to repeal this law and prevent further strife and death." The next letter comes from Veronica Uthi of Dumont. She writes, In regard to Sunday's paper of August 8th, such passion and conviction I hear in your letters to the editor and opinion columns, us versus them, I versus the other, right versus wrong, liberal versus conservative. When will all of this side-talking end? Why do some people feel the need to perpetuate differences rather than focus on commonalities and a common good? Where has division, inequality, and power struggles gotten us in our communities, our state, our country, and our world? How can any of us truly feel good about ourselves as inhabitants of this planet if we do not raise others up as we ourselves are able to rise? How can any of us sit idly by when anyone in our conscious awareness is designated different and or lesser than because of ill-based fears stoked by alternative facts or personal inferiority complexes? This is not about taking sides, assigning blame, or saying that I or anyone else is better than another. This is about pleading to the sensibilities of the human heart to see in another that which is a part of yourself. This is a call to action for intellectuals and activists alike. True change must come from the inside, whether it be individually, socially, in business, government, or country. I cannot judge, disparage, or throw stones at another until I am 100% certain in the purity of my own home. As I am sure that this is beyond my human ability, I will continue to advocate for tolerance, understanding, and mirror gazing for those who believe they are in the right or know from where another person is coming. Opinion, belief, societal standing, academic achievements, and etc. Passion, conviction, may we use such energy to unite and heal rather than to divide and conquer. That is my hope and love for all of us. That letter again is by Veronica Uthi of Dumont. Well, we've made it to the end of the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, August 15th, 2021. I've been your volunteer reader, Amy B. You can access the recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.